Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Turnbuckle Turmoil fans, Sun Guy with you here on another Sunday afternoon. QT is on assignment today, so he won't be joining us. But today, if you're looking for some pro wrestling, you have Gali Lucha Libre in Villa Park, Illinois. You have DOA's 10th anniversary show today in Portland, Oregon. And also in Portland today, you can find me at Blue Collar Wrestling like usual on a Sunday. And I would like to, at this point, welcome our guest on to the show, Drake Evans. Welcome to Turnbuckle Turmoil.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, since it's your first time with us, we're going to start you off with our first-timer's question. What led to you getting into the business of professional wrestling?
Well, like so many wrestlers, you know, you're a fan. You become a fan. I first experienced wrestling at a very young age because my grandfather was a fan, my father was a fan, and it was the match between Hulk Hogan and the Iron Sheik that I specifically remember turning me on to wrestling. I was 2 years old. It was when Hulk Hogan, Hulkamania, was born, and throughout the years, you know, watching it, I was like, man, I would really like to do this, and then a guy by the name of Brian Pillman came along. And I, like, stuck to him as my favorite wrestler, and he really inspired me because I was, as a kid and as a teenager, I wasn't really a big person. I was a small person, and Brian Pillman always personified the smaller wrestler, and I gravitated towards him and found myself a wrestling school, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Now, in the last year or so, Brian Pillman's son, Brian Pillman Jr., has actually made his professional wrestling debut, and he's doing very well. As someone that was inspired by Brian Pillman, have you tracked the progress of Brian Pillman Jr. at all?
I've actually been watching him very closely on Facebook. Him and I are Facebook friends, and I've been watching, you know, even the injury that he had, and I wouldn't mind one point in time stepping in a ring with Pillman Jr. just, you know, as he's the closest lineage to Brian Pillman that I could ever possibly step in a ring with. But yeah, no, he's a super talented kid, and he seems to have a lot of heart. He came off that knee injury relatively quick, which I know a lot about coming off of injuries quick. And he seems to be really doing really, really well for himself, and I wish him nothing but the best. He can live up to the name Brian Pillman.
Now, you mentioned healing up from injuries quick, and anyone that's been in professional wrestling knows that eventually injuries are going to crop up from time to time. I know you've had some injuries in your career. What's been some of the injuries that you've had to overcome in order to keep your career going?
Well, the one that I suffered during wrestling really wasn't too major. I tore my MCL back in 2006. I was able to rehab that on my own, never really took any time off for it. But the worst one that I had actually had nothing to do with wrestling. And the first one was I suffered a herniation of the C5, C6 disc in my neck due to a car accident when I was rear-ended. Which led to me having a cervical neck fusion back in 2014. And then most recently in June of this year, I was involved in another motor vehicle accident in which I was broadside. I was a passenger, and we were hit on my side of the vehicle, which led to a severe concussion, multiple lacerations, as well as a herniation, basically a fracture of the C4, C5 disc, which is right above my surgery that I had in 2014, which in this case I'm going on Thursday to discuss with my surgeon, possibly and most likely having a fusion of that disc to alleviate the pain so I can get back into wrestling.
One of the things that you've done in the later part of your career is you have trained a number of professional wrestlers. What gravitated you towards the training aspect of things, and was that something that you found that you actually enjoyed doing?
Yeah, you know, giving back to the business was always a big thing with me. I've been around the industry for 18 years. I've had well over 1,000 matches, and I figured giving back to the wrestling business with some students, because I'm not getting any younger, and you know, the longer that you're in it, the more your body's beat up, the more reality sets in, like, okay, if I can't make it to the big times, somebody that I trained could make it to the big time. So there's like a lineage there. I actually partnered up with somebody in 2007, opened up a promotion and a school. And being in New York, you don't really find, especially upstate New York, you really don't find a lot of wrestling schools. And if you do, it's very, a lot of times it's backyarders or people who've had partial training that are doing it and passing themselves off as trained wrestlers and stuff. So I figured at that point in time, it was time to start giving back while still pursuing my dream of making it to the WWE. And then that dream will never end, because if it does, then there's no point to even challenging yourself every day to do it. So we opened up the school, and, you know, I had a decent number of graduates, had a decent number of students come in, a decent number of graduates, which most of them are still wrestling and off doing their own thing. Some of them I talk to, some of them I don't. Some of them chose a completely different path and a completely different attitude than what I was trying to show them, but that's their issue. But the ones who listened and you know, conducted themselves in a professional manner, off doing things with, you know, good size indie promotions.
I talk about having had 1,000 matches in your career. Obviously, one of those had to be the longest match of your career. It's not as common anymore, but wrestling matches can still go upwards of an hour or sometimes slightly over that. What would you say has been the longest match that you've ever had?
I wrestled, I'd say it was 2005. I was wrestling a guy by the name of John Thornhill. I believe that the official time on the match was a little bit above 35 minutes. I've done hour-long matches in training. It's a little tough on the indies because the crowd's attention span's not there to do hour-long matches. There's very few guys that I know personally that would be able to hang for an hour. And you know, really the only one that I know that I could have an hour-long match with and bring it would be a guy by the name of Bobby Ocean, who's one of the top talents in the Northeast, and he's one of my best friends, and we've gone toe-to-toe. He'd probably be the match that I had with him would probably be the second longest that I've ever had, and that was about, I'd say, 25 minutes, I believe. And then I had a tag team match, which went about the same time, and that was me and Bobby Ocean teamed up against Bobby Fish and Fit Finlay.
In today's modern age of wrestling, you don't see a lot of the 2 out of 3 falls matches. There's not a lot of Iron Man matches out there, even though that the wrestlers themselves tend to be a little bit better athletes than generations ago. They have more advanced technology and advanced dietary knowledge to help them, like, achieve the greater athletic status. You don't see them going in matches that tend to last longer. You don't see the hour draws anywhere close to what we did a couple of generations ago. Why do you think that even though wrestlers seem to advance physically and with technology that could help them get in a little bit better shape than generations ago, that it seems to be the reverse trend where they don't go as long in matches?
I think it comes down to a couple of different aspects in that range, most of which it really comes down to crowd attention span. You see matches on TV and you could have two great wrestlers in the ring. Let's take Curt Hawkins and we'll say Curtis Axel, just as an example. If you put those two in the ring with each other, because they're lower on the card talents, but they're talented, they're still going to get this match stinks, the boos or them cheering and chanting for other wrestlers, because that's not what they want to see. The crowd wants to see specific things. They'd rather see, Drew McIntyre come out and demolish Roman Reigns or something like that. And I think that it really just comes down to the crowd's attention span. If you want to see a Iron Man match, it's got to be somebody that they want to see. I'm sure if you threw Dean Ambrose in there with Dolph Ziggler, maybe they'd want to see that. And those are two guys that could probably do an Iron Man match. I just honestly don't think that it's really the WWE per se. If we're going to use an example, they just don't want to deal with the chanting of, if they do an Iron Man match and it just so happens that that isn't what the crowd wants to see, they don't want to deal with the backlash for it. And the other aspect is really the things that I've noticed that go into the especially televised shows and stuff like that is they want everything tight. You really rarely ever see a 30-minute match, let alone a 20-minute match. So, I think the company itself, if they are able to add more into the show instead of, okay, we'll take this backstage segment and put it in, it's going to be 15 minutes, so we don't have to do an Iron Man match. And it's a really special match, and very special people can do it. And I think the last one was Cena and Shawn Michaels, I believe, was the last one that was televised on Monday Night Raw. And I really don't think that they've had one after that. And they are better conditioned wrestlers these days, but they're also not wrestling as much as the guys of yesteryear wrestled. So the guys of yesteryear may not have been in like great shape physically to look at, but they were wrestling 5-6 days a week, so they were in ring shape. They were cardiovascular wise, because the cardio you do in a gym is completely different than the cardio you're going to get from the wrestling ring. Completely different. And they're wrestling 5-6 days a week. They're getting that cardio 5-6 days a week.
Now, in your career, you've gone to several different promotions in several different areas. Everybody that's in wrestling tends to have that one favorite arena that they especially like to go to and compete in front of fans in that particular building. Do you find yourself having a favorite venue that you've had a chance to go to in your career?
I've had several. The Highgate Sports Arena in northern Vermont. It's in Highgate, Vermont, and the history of wrestling alone in that building was tremendous. Guys like Andre the Giant wrestled in that building. It's an old ice skating rink, and it was always special because that company took a chance on me, and I became the figurehead of that company for a while. It was a very good company. The draw was a little tough there because it was a very rural area. But at times they would bring in decent crowds, and it just like hollowed halls is what you think when you're walking through the building. And I wrestled up that way a few years back, and I drove by that building and just brought back so many memories. There's been so many buildings that I've wrestled in over the years that, you know, I like them all. Well, most of them, because I have wrestled on a farm before, and that was a little weird, but the Highgate Arena is what stands out as probably one of my most favorite arenas.
Now, on the flip side of that, wrestlers that have been around for any length of time have come across some strange venues, because promoters can put a ring up pretty much anywhere and often do. What would you say has been the strangest venue where you've had to compete?
I probably have to liken back to the farm. The dressing room was a greenhouse, and the ring was set up on the property of a farm, and that was in Rhode Island. And taking a second close finish to that one would probably be a garage behind a house in Rochester, New York. It was the old K-Fig Dojo Wrestling, which I ended up becoming one of the biggest promotions in Western New York. It's now currently called Upstate Pro Wrestling. It was the birth place of Luke Harper and Colin Delaney. And that was probably takes a second to the farm. But, I mean, it was fun. You couldn't fit a lot of people in there, but it was fun. The brotherhood in general, being in New York, we have strict commission regulations. So they take 10% of the ticket or 3% of the ticket sales. Sorry about that. They take 3% of the ticket sales. So you do a studio show like that inside of a garage and put it on TV, and you can kind of make some money off of it and not have to worry about paying a lot to the athletic commission.
Now, speaking of commissions, they are still very much a part of professional wrestling in some states, and commissions can vary a lot from state to state. Some of them are barely there to collect the tax money. Some of them are heavily involved and are a presence at every show. There's a lot of mileage between the different commissions. But just as a general rule yourself, do you think that commissions are a good thing or a bad thing for professional wrestling as it relates to the year 2018?
I would say both good and bad. I mean, they can help keep out a lot of the rogue feds that pop up, even though they still tend to pop up. New York State's rules and regulations are some of the strictest. As far as I'm to understand, they're a little less strict down in New York City as opposed to upstate. Legally, they're not supposed to allow license renting in the state of New York, but for some reason they still do. But as far as like injuring wrestlers and stuff like that, the insurance, I can understand that aspect of it. The rules and regulations that they stick on nowadays, you know, they just passed last year after MMA became legal in New York. They like tightened up the handcuffs on professional wrestling. Like now you have to have an ambulance on scene as well as a doctor in the state of New York. And ambulances can range between $200 and $300 an hour. And then the doctors, they can range anywhere from $200 to whatever they want to charge. I mean, the commission doesn't put a cap on that. So, I mean, in essence, it's a 50-50 thing when it comes to the commission. I was against them a whole 100% years ago, but, you know, I when I started working with them and I got a promoter's license with my business partner, we learned that, you know, if we keep them on our side and not cross them, they would work with us. But I personally think that it's about time that something happens, because to be honest with you, if I was still running the venue that I was running here in Albany, I'd be paying out $5,000 just to put one show on.
New York, a couple of years ago, actually tried to put a stop to an intergender match that was scheduled on a show. There was a big disagreement on what the actual rules on the books were. The commissioner could not provide the promoter with the rules, so the match was eventually allowed to take place after a very lengthy delay. Intergender wrestling is a little bit of a controversial topic in 2018. There's a lot of people on both sides of the fence on if it should be allowed to happen or not. What's your stance on intergender matches?
I don't mind them too much. I mean, I took big steps in not booking intergender matches when I was running a promotion, and not really from the standpoint of not, you know, I'm not sexist or anything like that, you know, because the first thing everybody comes to mind is that that's what it is. It's just what makes sense and what's believability, you know, what's believable to the crowd. If I got a 120-pound woman beating up a 260-pound man, believability factor, if that woman better be a third, fourth, or fifth degree black belt in the martial arts, because, I mean, it's the believability factor. Intergender tag team matches are a little bit more doable because you got male-female versus male-female and stuff like that. I'm not wholly against it. I don't hate it. It's just not something that I would book, and I am familiar with that situation. And I was actually got myself into a discussion with the Athletic Commission because I had a segment on one of my shows where one of the females was jumped. It wasn't a match, but the female was beat up by some male wrestlers, you know, and he started to have a fit about it. And I was like, there's nothing stating that this can't happen. She's a trained wrestler. And he was like, oh, because it was involving a baseball bat. Well, I'll tell you right now, the baseball bat never connected with her. I mean, it's like you have to sit there and explain it to these people, because they're either believing everything they're seeing or they're thinking that it's going to come back onto them somehow, which, you know, it is what it is when it comes to them. But, yeah, as far as intergender matches, I've been on shows with them. I don't hate them. It's just not something that I would have, unless it made sense, not something that I would book on my shows.
Fair enough. One of the things that professional wrestlers do to make revenue happen for them, especially at the independent level, is merchandising. Most wrestlers have T-shirts or hats. A lot of them get creative. They have stickers, temporary tattoos. I've seen everything from sunglasses to key rings to bookmarks. Have you in your career done a whole lot of merchandising to try to get products into fans' hands and get a little bit of a cash flow into your pockets?
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, I've done T-shirts, headbands, wristbands, 10s, 4x6s. It's a revolving circle of things when it comes to merchandise, and you just got to find that one thing that stands out. Me personally, it was always hard with me because typically I'm the heel, and typically heels don't sell merchandise. So it's hard to push merchandise as a heel, but I've done it. I mean, I was a top heel in a company out in Dunkirk, New York. And in one night I sold about $100 worth of merchandise, even to the people that I was insulting. I talked the lady, I told her she smelled, talked the lady and the same lady into buying a T-shirt. But yeah, I mean, because the way that the economy works, and when I first started wrestling, $10 in gas would get you from Albany, New York to Cleveland, Ohio, and you wouldn't really have a problem. Nowadays, $10 will probably get you from Albany, New York to maybe Catskill, New York. So it's a big difference in the economy. So you have to offset your cost. And honestly, promoters ain't really paying a whole lot, you know. And which is okay because they're trying to build a brand. And, you know, you got a promoter paying you $25, $50, $75, and you need to make up, you know, for being able to provide gas, tolls, and food. And that's where the merchandising comes in. But you got to look up. What I do is I usually look around at the other wrestlers and see what they're selling. And then I'm going to bring something that they're not selling. If they're not selling wristbands, I'm going to bring wristbands. Clearly, everybody's selling 8x10s, but that's a given. But and T-shirts, too, selling. I see a lot of guys buying generic masks. I don't do it, but they bring them to the shows, and they sell them, and they make a killing on them. I mean, and as a promoter, we always kept a plethora of T-shirts and different merchandise. We had those the foam fingers from, like, the 1980s. We got those made up for the company and sold those, and DVDs, which I was never really a huge fan of because DVDs don't sell and everybody wants to watch things on YouTube. But, you know, certain people that were close to me in that company, you know, my business partner, he was stuck on selling DVDs that he never sold, which, you know, could explain why certain things kind of went downhill.
You mentioned a lot of the merchandise that wrestlers have on merchandise tables all across the country. Off the top of your head, what would you say has been the strangest thing that you've seen a wrestler trying to sell to fans?
Strangest thing. I'd probably have to say candy was a little odd. But I mean, he sold it. I'd probably have to say the oddest part was candy. Of course, the
fair enough. I've
like
actually seen cupcakes at merchandise tables.
That does not surprise me.
You mentioned a minute ago about how you used to go from Albany to Cleveland and Albany up to Catskills on the $10 of gas. Wrestling on the independent level requires people to usually drive quite a distance to get the bookings, especially out here in the Pacific Northwest, where things aren't as close together, so you have to drive usually several hours to get between bookings. What would you say has been the farthest car ride that you have had to make in order to get to your bookings?
I wrestled my early days because I was a small little spitfire in my early days, so a lot of the promoters always liked booking me for jobbing. But I went out to the Chicago area circa, I'd say probably 2000-2001, and that was a pretty good distance. But I'm pretty sure the Michigan trip was further because it was down, up, and around. So it's either between Michigan and Illinois as being the furthest. I did fly down. I flew down to Nashville, Tennessee last year and did a show in Murfreesboro. But I don't think that's not a drive. That's a flight. But that I would say probably Chicago would be maybe a bit longer than Detroit, but I'd have to do the math on that. It's been so long since I've been out that way.
I've always noticed, at least in my view, that wrestling fans tend to gravitate towards the style of wrestling that they had in a given territory where they were. For example, fans in Tennessee usually respond a little bit better if people are working the Memphis style of match, which is a little more flashy and character based, where if you go to, say, an Oklahoma, the fans there are going to respond to more of a technical based scientific match because that's what they had in the Leroy McGuirk territory. If you go to Detroit, those fans want a lot of brawling and bloodshed like the Sheik had in his territory days. Is this something that you've noticed as you've gone to different parts of the country and wrestled in front of different types of fans?
Oh yeah, definitely. When I was down in Tennessee, they liked they seemed to like the basic punching, kicking, drop kick. Yeah, the normal like Jerry Lawler style wrestling. So that actually is very a very true statement about Tennessee. New York, we tend to like more towards the ECW style of things, which can also fall into the Detroit territory, but we're not that far off from Detroit. The whole sector, like if you do Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, New York, that tends to be more of the ECW chic style of wrestling. Whereas like Virginia to Tennessee is basically the Southern style, you know, the mid Southern style of wrestling, which is the Lawler type. Then you get down into the Southern, like Georgia and Florida. And I believe that's more like the catch as catch can style, you know, the old school, mid-South, wrestling, you know, Ric Flair's and Ricky Steamboat and stuff like that. It's a hodgepodge of everything. But yeah, every sector, I haven't yet to wrestle in California, but they're like a hybrid of everything. From what I can see, I know people who have wrestled in California and I know people who currently wrestle in California, and it's, you know, a whole nother world, but they, you know, it's something that as a wrestler, you got to learn to adapt to. And the one thing that I've always believed in the 18 years that I've been around the business was you can't plan for everything when you're in the back. You have to be able to go on the fly. You don't know what if you've never wrestled in that territory, that area, you better prepare yourself to go out into that ring and learn really fast. And that's the way that I used to teach people how to do things, you know, working on the fly, going into the ring and feeling the crowd and getting a feel for what they want to see, because ultimately in the end, it's their money paying for what you're doing and they want to see a specific thing. You better be prepared to do that. So as a student of the game, any decent wrestler or good entertainer knows that you have to play for the crowd, therefore be willing to adapt to each crowd into each territory. So if you go out to the West Coast, you better be able to provide for them the wrestling that Don Owens was promoting, and, you know, be able to work in that style of wrestling, because chances are those, especially the indie fans, are going to remember the smaller territory days, and they're going to want to see that specific wrestling.
As independent wrestling in particular gains more and more popularity, we're seeing a plethora of different styles increasing with a lot of groups of fans. It's easier to enjoy a niche style of wrestling because a lot of promotions gravitate towards that one specific style. There's a lot more accessibility to see not only individual promotions, but individual wrestlers on streaming services and the internet and so forth. With so many styles of wrestling out there now, do you have a particular favorite style that you like to employ, and or do you have a favorite style of opponent that you most like to wrestle?
I really don't. I'm a very adaptable wrestler. I will go with the flow when it comes to what the crowd wants to see. Generally, my style of wrestling is very straightforward and very, I don't know. I hate using the term strong style because it's not the term that people really think that it is. I'm a very intense wrestler, so everything that I do comes with intensity. So you know, it harkens people to think Japanese wrestling when they're watching me wrestle. I've been compared to guys like Dean Malenko and Chris Benoit for my intensity and then my technical ability in the ring. But as far as, you know, guys that I prefer to wrestle, I wrestle anybody. I mean, if they told me to go out and wrestle a mop, I'd go out and wrestle a mop, and I'd do my best to make that mop look like 100%.
Well, we have a game on our show that we like to play. We call it Bring On the Choice, Bring On the Funk. I think you might be a perfect candidate for this. I will give a series of two options, and the one that you prefer is the answer. Are you prepared for a round of Bring On the Choice, Bring On the Funk?
Sure, let's bring on the choice and bring on the funk.
All right, the first one, Claw Hold or Full Nelson?
Full Nelson.
Tights or trunks?
Tights.
Boots or shoes and kick pads?
Always boots.
Tennis or golf?
Ugh, I hate them both, but I'd probably have to pick tennis because I could follow it a little bit better.
Christmas or Thanksgiving?
Christmas.
Walmart or Target?
Well, you know, in this never-ending world of weird economies, I'd have to say Walmart because it's cheaper.
Terry Taylor or Terry Funk?
Terry Funk.
Moonsault or Canadian Destroyer?
Moonsault.
The last one, Jim Ross or Lance Russell?
Lance Russell, because I'm an old school fan.
A lot of fans may not appreciate how vital to a television product that the announcers always have been. In this day and age of live streaming services and promotions relying on YouTube heavily, wrestling announcers are not something that are abundant, but a lot of companies need them more than ever. Do you think that on the independent level, there are enough competent, trained wrestling announcers to be able to do these shows compared to what the massive amount of content being pumped out is?
I'd say that there's lacking in that department, definitely. I know a few, and I know a few really good ones. I've been around a few that have done the live recording. I usually don't pay much attention to that. I've done a bit of commentating myself. Not a huge fan of doing it myself. I can do it. I'd rather be the one performing in the ring. But, Brian Cady, he's a guy from my area. He used to work for ESPN Radio, and I've seen him do it, and I've heard his stuff, and he's really good. But you need a good announcer, a good play-by-play guy, caller guy, because they help sell the product. They help sell the match. There may be a move that a fan sees that they don't know what it is that announcer can, put it over and say what it is, and then, the fan can go and find other people that do it, or maybe, they won't be sitting there, oh, what's that, what's that? They also help tell the story of a match. If you ever listen to Jim Ross has saved more matches on TV than anyone, because of his style of calling. And then you add in the color guy like Jerry Lawler, who complimented him, and it's a match made in heaven. I've also seen a lot of indie shows on YouTube that they probably shouldn't even attempt to do the commentating, because the guys that they got wouldn't know a wristwatch from a wrist lock, and they call a headlock a head hold. And, you sit there scratching your head like, where the heck are these guys from, Mars?
Some promotions, at least up here in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm sure there's promotions all over the country that do this, they will have people doing live commentary over the house microphone for the live crowd. What's your opinion on promotions that employ this?
They need to be buried. they need a good lesson in promoting, because basically you're advertising. If a bad guy is cheating, and they're yelling over the microphone, look at so-and-so, he's getting involved in the match. Why isn't the ref calling for a disqualification? You know, it's a stupid thing to do, and most companies who do it are very questionable companies in general, but I hate live commentary over the house mic. I've been a part of a few promotions that have done it, and it's just, you sit there and you shake your head, and, you know, it's just like, it's not cool. You know, get a mixer or do the commentary after the fact, or, you know, learn to do the commentary through a computer during the show, but never, ever over the house mic. It just makes zero sense.
I agree with you there. And for the record, I have actually disqualified people when that's happened.
Good.
Now, one of the things that seems like it might be starting to make a bit of a comeback on a national level, and it's not been very prominent at that level for some time, it's a little bit more frequent on the independent level, is the role of the wrestling manager. I know on the independent level there's still some very good quality managers out there. It seemed like it was a dying art, but looks like maybe the bigger companies are starting to test the waters to see if managers are viable in this age of wrestling. What's your opinion on managers in general, and do you think that there's still a place for them in 2018?
Oh, of course. Yeah, we'll never go back to the days of having a Bobby the Brain Heenan or a Grand Wizard or a Lou Albano or anything like that, but there's definitely a place for them. There's a lot of wrestlers who are out and about, and I've trained a few who have a hard time with speaking, especially in front of a crowd. And there's where the managers come into play. Yeah, you get a guy like Paul Heyman who makes up for the lack of emotion inside Brock Lesnar. You know, Lesnar could cut a promo if he wanted to, but it to me, it lacks emotion because he's a straightforward guy. So Heyman was brought in to complement that. I know a few independent managers, and as long as they're properly trained, they do well. I've also seen a few who were just friends of the promoter that they just threw in there, and girlfriends of a wrestler and stuff like that. And that's not how it should be. But I do believe that managers are a good asset in the business and could work very well in the indies, especially with guys who are trying to learn how to speak. You know, for years, Bret Hart had a problem with it until he put the sunglasses on, but they had Jimmy Hart. Not that they really needed him because they had Jim Neidhart, but, you know, managers are also good assets for outside the ring for the cheating aspect. And, you know, they're an all-around tool. I've seen managers who remember parts of the match, the wrestler, you know, go through the match. And it takes a little bit of stress off of certain wrestlers. I've had managers myself, never quite understood why, just recently, at the beginning of this year, I got stuck with a manager, and that's all the guy did was talk. Like, he went out into the ring, and he's cutting a 10-minute promo, and I'm sitting there trying to cut him off, and he's my manager. I don't need a manager to talk for me. I can talk for myself, especially when it comes to promos. It's one of my strong suits. Yeah. And I was just a friend of the promoter that he wanted to give a spot because he was using his license.
Another aspect in wrestling that is often overlooked and underappreciated, not only by fans, but by a lot of promoters, a lot of other people within the business, is the referee. Referees really can control a match. If they know what they're doing, they can make a bad match more palatable. They can also actually lead younger people if need be. A lot of promoters are very quick to just send whoever has a black and white shirt to the ring, sometimes not even that much, and let them officiate. Who are some of the better referees that you think don't quite get the credit they deserve? And do you think enough promoters, as a general rule on the independents, really put a lot of stock into having good referees on their shows?
I know a few decent referees. I actually trained some referees. Actually, anybody who came through my school was a referee before they wrestled. That was the first thing that they learned was how to referee. And I actually had one guy, or two guys, actually graduate as referees, and they were specifically taught just refereeing. And one of the guys, his name is Tony Constantino, and he's the bat boy for one of our local minor league pro baseball teams. And he did well for himself. Another referee that comes to mind that he's from the southern part of New York. His name is Vinny Lax. And he does primarily ref for Northeast Wrestling, which is one of the bigger indie companies in the Northeast. Like, they bring in top level guys like Jack Swagger and stuff like that. And that guy will sit there and he'll memorize everything about what's going on that night. And he will guide the match so smoothly and take a lot of stress off a lot of the performers and stuff. And, you know, as far as like promoters just throwing guys out there, I've been part of that too. Like, I've been to the point where I've had to actually walk the referee through the match. Like, if he was supposed to have his back turned, I'd grab him by the shirt and pull him towards me and be like, just listen to me. And, you know, because I've had referees blow spots for me. And it's just garbage, because a lot of these guys just ain't being trained properly. They're not being trained. But the few that the you'll always know the good ones, because the crowd won't give them crap. The crappy ones, the crowd will, especially here in the Northeast, the crowd will get on them if they blow spots and stuff like that.
As they should. Now, a lot of times the referees are in a match and they will be the more experienced person in the match. And like I said, they will be able to lead guys. They will be able to help when need be. If there's an injury, they can help cover it. Do you think overall that today's standard independent wrestlers really know how to work with the referee, or do you think that they get tunnel vision a lot and don't really know that they're being helped by the referee when they're in there?
I think a lot of it is they get scared and they get that tunnel vision and don't realize that the referee is there to help them. Usually when somebody finds out they have to wrestle with me or work with me, they get nervous, because they have watched my videos, and I'm an intense wrestler, and everything that I do, not tooting my own horn, but everything that I do looks like I'm killing my opponents. I've never hurt anybody in my entire career, but it looks like I'm vicious. So they get nervous, and then, you know, they will hide in a corner or follow me around. And I hate calling stuff in the back. It's more like, see out there, kid. And it's usually, I'll tell them, calm down, listen to me, listen to the ref. And, you know, whatever you're hearing, just follow. And I'll utilize the ref just to show them, especially the new people, especially when I go down to test the strength wrestling in East Hartford, Connecticut. That's the school that I do student shows, or help the trainer out with his students and stuff like that. I'll help out a lot of the younger guys with learning to use the referee to their advantage. The referee is there for a reason. The referee is the most important man in the match, no matter, hands down, no matter which way you want to look at it. Because a crappy referee, like you said, can make a match look really crappy, no matter how great It could be Ric Flair and Sting in there. It could be Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat in there. There's a crappy referee in there. That match is going to look like crap. And, you know, you got to be able to use every advantage. So that's what I do. But there is a lot of guys who are not taught how to utilize the ref. That's where my training and the way that I train people came into, you know, being different, because I was always taught to utilize the ref. And I always taught my guys how to utilize the ref and, you know, utilize every aspect of the ring, what's in the ring, what's outside the ring, use it to your advantage. And that's the difference between me and some other trainers, but there's a lot of trainers out there who just teach the meat and potatoes of the business and don't teach, you know, the way to captivate an audience, the way to use a referee, the way to use your movements in the ring instead of just going through the motions of hitting moves. You know, there's a difference between, you know, taking a snapmare and a rear chin lock and just sitting there. You take that snapmare and the rear chin lock and you look up at the crowd and you give them a look and, you know, you make it, you know, that makes that moment that tells the story. And there's just a lot of trainers who are not teaching that.
Now, as someone that has been in the industry for a number of years and is someone that has trained people to work in the industry, if there are young wrestlers listening today, what's the one thing that you would most like to see younger wrestlers remember the most as they are just starting their career?
Mm-hmm. The thing that I always tell everybody is sit down, shut your mouth, open your ears, ever forget who took the time out of their life, who took the time out of their family to show you what you need to know to make you great. Because the minute that you lose sight of who you are and where you came from, it totally diminishes any credibility that you have, not just in the ring, not just as a student, but in life. Because, you know, without those sacrifices that people are making for you, you just don't, you wouldn't have what you have today if they didn't do that for you. And I'm 100% have had that happen, you know, where people just forgot where they came from. Open your ears, shut your mouth, listen, absorb, you're a sponge. Learn everything. Go to seminars. Go to look at some drama classes. Learn everything you can about the art and entertainment of professional wrestling, and listen to the guys that came before you. Because if you don't, you'll never have a clue. If you listen to the guys that are still training with you, or have a couple years experience, you're gonna learn nothing, because they're just as, in our world, green as you are.
Well, at this point, we have just a few minutes left in the show, and I want to give you ample time. If there is anything you would like to say at all to the listeners, plug and promote anything and everything you got, social medias, upcoming appearances, merchandise, your favorite dry cleaner, anything in the world, floor is all yours.
Okay, yeah, no, I mean, I just want to give a shout out to Tessa Strength Wrestling, who's going to be holding a couple of training day shows in October, one on the 14th and one on the 28th. That's in East Hartford, Connecticut. And their Facebook page is facebook.com/Tessa Strength Wrestling. It's a great group of guys. The head trainers are great guys named Slick Wagner Brown. He's been all over the world himself. On October 6th, Regional Championship Wrestling out of Reading, Pennsylvania is holding a show. You can check out that information at facebook.com/RCW Pro Wrestling. New World Wrestling Extremes, another company I wrestle for, they're coming back strong next year. You can check them out at facebook.com/NWW Pro Wrestling Extreme. And one of the newer companies that I started wrestling for, Infinite Pro Wrestling, they're based in Delaware, but they're actually holding a show on November 17th in Columbus, Ohio, featuring former WWE star Simon Gotch. You can check them out at infiniteprowrestling.com. And I will and should be appearing at the AuthorCon and ParaHorror Fest on October 12th and 13th. That's going to be at the Foothills Performing Arts Center in Oneonta, New York. www.authorcon/parahorrorfestival.com. You could see me, you could see Shane Douglas, Dominic DiNucci, Tito Santana, Danny Davis, and varying other professional wrestlers, some great vendors such as Scott Wilder Promotions. It's sure to be a great night. Should be some actors, good actors there, and some authors. And me, I'm always available on Facebook at facebook.com/DrakeEvans82. And you can find me on Twitter. Just search up at DrakeEvans82. That's my handle. And I appreciate you guys having me on the show and would love to do it again at some other point in time. And that's pretty much it. And as far as my wrestling career goes, who knows? I'm probably going into having surgery within a month or so to get my neck repaired and should be back in the ring. Probably, I'd say, April 2019. So look out for Drake Evans because he's coming back, and he's coming back better than ever.
Well, Drake Evans, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. Best of luck as you continue to rehab and get better. And I look forward to the comeback, and I look forward to having you back on the show at some point.
Excellent. Sounds good. And if anybody wants to check me out on YouTube, just look up Drake Evans. There's plenty of matches.
All right, fans, get out there. Support your local independent pro wrestling wherever it might be. I will see the fans in Portland at Blue Collar in a few hours. And when Drake Evans makes his comeback, make sure if he's on a show near you, you go buy yourself a ticket. He's very, very good at what he does. I think you'll enjoy him. And we'll be back with you next week. Next Friday afternoon, we have Sean Angel out of Woo America and Blue Collar Wrestling. And then a week from today, we'll be joined by veteran wrestler Rock Parsons. So it should be outstanding next week, and we will talk to you then.